From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. I'm recording this on February 4th, 2019. I want to start with an article looking at heart failure with preserved ejection fraction and the relationship to diabetes. Then I'm going to take a look at two articles coming out this week in JACC having to do with the long-term durability of tissue aortic valves, one of them a TAVR study and the other a study looking at surgical aortic valve replacement versus the transcatheter approach. All of these articles can be found this week in JACC on acc.org. So let's start with a really nice review of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction and specifically the cohort with diabetes. As you're aware, HFpEF is a very heterogeneous syndrome. It's got multiple distinct phenotypes. We're still trying to figure out how to properly phenotype it so we can manage it properly. Is the stiffening due to fibrosis? Is it due to ischemia? Is it due to hypertrophy? Is it due to infiltration? Combinations of all of the above. So there's a lot to learn. This is a nice review which looks at HFpEF, particularly with a focus on diabetes. So it's useful to remember that HFpEF is actually more common, more prevalent than HFrEF, and interestingly, has a higher mortality and a higher readmission rate. One important phenotype is probably the coexistence with diabetes, and that's almost half the patients, 45% of patients with HFpEF have diabetes. If you look at the large trials, four large clinical trials of HFpEF, that's EF greater than 40 or greater than 50, the association of diabetes was important. Higher all-cause and cardiovascular mortality and higher heart failure readmissions in HFpEF than in HFrEF. Clinical trial data also suggested that diabetes in HFpEF was associated with a higher burden of comorbidities, poor functional status, elevated markers of inflammation, and more volume overload. If one looks at the over 200,000 patients with HFpEF in the Get with the Guidelines Heart Failure Registry, the patients with HFpEF and diabetes tended to be younger, but they had more comorbidities compared to those without diabetes. And interestingly, on multivariable analysis, the presence of diabetes was not independently associated with hospital mortality, but it was noted for longer length of stay and a higher risk of 30-day admission and heart failure readmission. So probably there are a couple of things at play here. One of them is that patients with diabetes may have hemodynamic mechanistic differences that lead them to volume overload that's quicker than the other forms. And studying the mechanisms of this may be helpful in terms of future therapies. So one of the areas which is quite interesting is sodium handling. Diabetics have alterations in sodium handling and predisposes them to have congestion, cardiorenal syndrome, and decreased responsiveness to diuretics. So one of these is the upregulation of sodium glucose cotransporter 2, SGL2 receptors. This leads to an increase in sodium absorption. And in the randomized trials of cardiovascular disease and diabetes, the use of these SGLT2 inhibitors has been associated with a reduction in cardiovascular endpoints and heart failure hospitalizations. Studies of SGLT2 inhibition and HFpEF are currently ongoing. Another area of interest would be the increased adiposity seen in diabetics. This causes a release of pro-inflammatory cytokines. And so restricting calories and reducing weight may help diabetics by reducing the inflammation that's associated with this phenomenon. Additional mechanisms could be fatty acid oxidation, lower nitric oxide levels, and advanced glycation end products. Targeting these types of pathways could affect remodeling of the heart and reduce mortality. For example, glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists seem to reduce atherosclerotic burden, inflammation, and endothelial dysfunction. We need studies of these in HFpEF. Neprilysin inhibition improves endothelial function and reduces myocyte stiffness. This is being tested currently in a trial among HFpEF patients called Paragon HF. Also, poor functional status among diabetics with HFpEF is very common. It's probably partly due to skeletal muscle function changes with age and with diabetes, as well as impaired oxygen delivery and chronotropic incompetence. So improving functional capacity clearly helps HFpEF patients do better. Also, the higher burden of comorbidity in patients with both diabetes and HFpEF is really a common problem. And it calls upon our need for a real heart care team. That includes cardiologists, endocrinologists, primary care docs, and when appropriate, heart failure specialists to manage this disease. The whole area of HFpEF is undergoing rapid evolution as we learn to characterize the phenotype better and we study the mechanisms that hopefully will lead us to better and more targeted therapies. So let's shift gears and talk about valve disease. There are two papers in JACC I wanted to cover this week. The first one's entitled Long-Term Durability of Transcatheter Aortic Valve Prostheses. And the study really is looking at what's the level of structural valve degeneration 5 to 10 years after a TAVR. In this case, the authors used the United Kingdom Transcatheter Aortic Valve Implantation Registry, and they looked at patients in the registry who had both clinical and echocardiographic data available at baseline and more than 5 years after a TAVR. There were a total of 241 patients. Their average age was about 80. Almost half were female, and they were studied both at the three-month mark and out at about 6 years. 64% of them had the self-expanding valve, and 35% had a balloon-expanded valve. The median follow-up at echo, as I mentioned, was about 6 years. Compared to 6 months after the procedure, the peak gradient at follow-up generally was pretty similar, around 17 to 19 millimeters. More patients had, of course, no or trivial AR at follow-up, 47% versus 33%. Very few had mild AR. There was only one case of severe valve disease at 5.3 years, and this was a patient who had new severe AR. In terms of moderate disease, there were 21 patients who had that. 12 of them were aortic valve regurgitation, and 9 were due to prosthetic stenosis. So overall, the study showed that 91% of patients seemed pretty free of significant valve disease out at about 6 years. There was less than 1% incidence of severe disease, and about 8% had moderate disease. Clearly, an important paper after TAVR. We really, of course, need the 10 to 20-year follow-up before we're going to feel good about the durability. Let's move on then to the third study, which examined the differences in durability between TAVR and surgical bioprosthetic aortic valve replacement, SAVR. This study came from NOTION, which is the Nordic Aortic Valve Intervention Trial. This included patients over the age of 70. They had to have severe AS, and they had a low STS score average of 3, most of them less than 10%. And they were randomized to TAVR or to a surgical valve. Moderate or severe structural valve deterioration was defined as a mean gradient greater than or equal to 20, or an increase in mean gradient of more than 10 from the three-month post-procedure study, or more than mild intraprosthetic aortic regurgitation, either new or worsening at 3 months. Non-structural valve deterioration was defined as moderate to severe patient prosthesis mismatch at 3 months or moderate or severe paravalvular aortic valve regurgitation. And bioprosthetic valve failure was defined as valve-related death, aortic valve reintervention, or severe hemodynamic valve disease. So at 6 years, the rates of all-cause mortality were similar for TAVR and SAVR, both around 40%. The rate of severe valve disease was higher for SAVR, 24% versus about 5% for the TAVR group. There were no significant differences in the non-structural valve deterioration in the two, and there were no differences in the rates of endocarditis at all. So it was interesting. The NOTION trial really suggested that significant valve disease was more common after SAVR than TAVR. This certainly is reassuring since we're using a lower-risk technology and hoping for a good 6-year and beyond valve-related outcomes. So I think this study certainly is reassuring that in our current mode, using the TAVR approach appears to have not only a short-term benefits in terms of risk and length of stay, but also in appropriately selected patients, the outcomes that are now moderate term, I would say out to 6 years or so, look to be as good or perhaps even better than SAVR. So I want to thank you for listening to this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org, and you can find all this information on our website. We have a new educational catalog as well, which is located under Education and Meetings tab on ACC.org. I want to mention a retraction. I covered a paper a few weeks ago that was in the European Heart Journal looking at the potential value of high-dose statin therapy initiated the night before PCI. That paper subsequently got retracted from the European Heart Journal, and I wanted to point that out to you. We certainly try to cover articles that have the highest methodologic standards, but sometimes things happen, and that was certainly one where I want to call attention to you that the paper was retracted. So I look forward to talking to you again next week, and until then, hope you have a good one. Thank you.